This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. With Mint, you can get the coverage and speed you're used to, but for way less money. And for a limited time, Mint Mobile is offering 3 months of unlimited premium wireless service for $15 a month. So while your friends are sweating over data overages and surprise charges, you'll be chilling, literally and financially. Say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans of Mint Mobile come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch the overpriced wireless and get 3 months of unlimited service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. Listen, I'm with one of the big wireless carriers, and it's time to ditch them because my bills are way too high, and it's time to move over to Mint Mobile. So this year, skip breaking a sweat and breaking the bank. Get this new customer offer and your 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month at mintmobile.com/curb. That's mintmobile.com/curb. Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 per month. Limited time new customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
I can't tell if this is offensive, if I need to cut this out or not.
Yeah, no good is going to come of this episode. I guess you're like, we were going to do an episode on hypernatremia. We just decided to skip the whole thing.
Is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're right.
Well, hi, and welcome back to the Curbsiders.
Hi, Stuart. I can't believe you started the show.
I know. I was trying to see if I could.
You're actually moving us along instead of slowing us down. I know. Isn't that amazing?
That's because it's super late.
It is super late. So I should mention that this show is going to be about hypernatremia. We have our chief of Cashlack, Joel Topf. We are all quite delirious right now. We just had a really great show with Joel Topf.
Yeah.
I will remind the audience that on this show, we curbside the experts to bring them clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And in the air of full disclosure, we do spend about 10 minutes up front talking about things just outside the world of medicine that kind of make us human.
Just skip it.
And Paul would always like to remind you that if you do skip that part, you're probably a bad person.
I won't blame you this time.
And now I will introduce our wonderful returning guest host, Hannah R. Abrams, soon to be Dr. Hannah R. Abrams in just a couple more months here.
You hear that? That's me knocking on wood. But yes, tonight we covered a whole lot of ground in terms of hypernatremia. We learned about diagnosis, differentiating peripheral from central DI, treatment of hypernatremia, and some of kind of the newer evidence about that. We just learned quite a bit from Dr. Topf.
Hannah, did you want to read his bio?
Yeah, who is Dr. Topf?
Dr. Topf is a regular on the Curbsider, so this is his 11th appearance, and I actually had to go through and count them all up. And that's why he's the chief of nephrology at Cashlack Memorial Hospital. He is better known as his much cooler and more intelligent online alter ego, @kidney_boy, where he employs innovative medical education to teach nephrology. He is the co-creator of NephJC and NephMadness, and in 2017, he won the Robert Nairns Award from the ASN. His day job is as a clinical nephrologist at a teaching hospital where he teaches medical students from Oakland University, William Beaumont School of Medicine, Wayne State University, St. George's, and Central Michigan University. He also teaches residents and nephrology fellows at St. John's Ascension in Detroit. All right, so I think we were going to have a pun here, and then we decided, nah.
We already used that one.
Oh, no.
That was like the hyponatremia one. Oh, my gosh. Jeez. That's a horrible pun.
I'm learning that Stuart doesn't like other people's puns, only his own.
That's probably true.
Joel, it's so great to have you back. You are our chief of nephrology, and I'm told this is your 11th appearance.
I am honored to be back. I'm excited to be here. I really appreciate the invitation.
It is the 11th hour.
Okay, Stuart. I'm just going to blow by that. Joel, did you want to, any updates that you wanted to give the audience? I heard maybe you have a podcast now that they might be interested in.
Well, I'm not sure if they'll be interested in it, but we've the NefJC crew has started doing a podcast. It's called Freely Filtered, and we essentially take the previous week's NefJC discussion, and we have about an hour long discussion about the article. It's kind of a really good journal club with five people, and it's been a lot of fun doing. I've been enjoying it. What you guys make it look easy. It is really hard to do these things. I have more respect for the curbsiders, and I had a lot to begin with, but it is a labor intensive project.
I thought I was going to be called Joel Topf, raw and unfiltered.
We are not that good. We are completely filtered.
That's his late night podcast. It's a totally different audience.
I use a pseudonym for that one. I thought we were going to keep that quiet, guys. Come on.
You ever watch Parks and Recreation? How Ron Swanson had this like, I forget, he was like a saxophone player, like this famous jazz musician. It was like kind of a secret. Anyway, kind of reminds me. I could see you, Joel, having that same sort of alter ego, at, you know, where you play a jazz saxophone in clubs in Detroit on your time off.
Yeah, being compared to Ron Swanson's my high point of my life.
He's wonderful. There you go. Stuart's got a picture of him up there. Hannah, I believe you had a punny question for people here.
What?
Oh, yeah. Well, so what I was kind of wondering, if you could be any part of the Nephron, which would you be and why for all of y'all?
I will, of course, refuse to answer this, but I would love for you to tell me.
I made up an answer for you. Don't worry.
I figured you would have.
Well, you ask the question. I think Hannah has to go first.
Exactly.
Oh yeah. So I'm the macula densa because I'm kind of small and I like to be in control of what's going on in my life. Since Paul isn't here, came up with one for him too. He's kind of the proximal collecting tubule, in that he sort of takes everything in very calmly and then adds like a little bit of sort of acerbic humor, sort of the ammoniogenesis of the show.
Okay, I'm game. What do you think I am?
Well, do you have one for yourself?
No. Okay. Not at all.
So I thought you were the peritubular capillary because you move really quickly and then you bring in all the stuff from outside, like the Amazon stuff and the pictures and
the ridiculous thing is that you put some thought into this.
And then
I probably put excessive thought into this.
And then Paul and I have to try to bring it back on the rails.
So you're saying you're the loop of Henley?
I am the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henley, right? I am the engine that drives this podcast forward.
So Matt is the collecting duct. He's the medullary collecting duct because he fine tunes it all for us and somehow makes us all sound good.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
All right, Hannah. That's very, very well thought out. A very well thought out pun. I'm always impressed. Did you want to follow that up with a pick of the week for the audience?
Yeah. So this week I read the book In Shock by Rana Oddish. Have you guys read this book?
No, not at all.
Oh, it's absolutely amazing. So she was about to start ICU attending when she suddenly became critically ill and had the experience of being a patient kind of in her own ICU. And she talks about the experience of being a critically ill patient and how it gave her a lot of insight into the acute process, the recovery, and sort of communication as a doctor. It's absolutely amazing. So I saw a couple excerpts of it on Twitter, and I realized that just that was kind of changing how I talk to people. So I figured I had to read the whole book, and it's definitely kind of practice-changing, communication-changing, at least for me.
I'm sold. That sounds amazing.
I read it in like 24 hours because it was so good.
Joel, what about you?
So I got real excited about the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, and HBO has this old miniseries called From the Earth to the Moon. Tom Hanks produced it. I think he did this after Apollo 13. And it's 10 episodes that cover kind of every element of the Apollo mission. And there's a lot of nerd stuff, like how did they come up with the idea of the lunar lander and how do they build it? And it's really good, but it is wild. Like every single character in that show is a white male. There's not a woman. There's not an Asian. It's shocking to think that, and what really solidified this is I just recently saw, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Have you guys seen this yet?
No, so it's on the list. I think Paul recommended it recently.
Yeah, it's the new Tarantino movie, and it's a 1969 Hollywood. And again, same thing. It is a white male world. Like, and I get this, to some degree, we're still there, but boy, is it different than we were in 1969. It is kind of crazy to look back that way. Kind of a look back to the past.
Stuart,
I'd recommend Earth to the Moon. It's pretty good podcast if you're interested in Apollo. And by podcast, I mean miniseries.
Podcast.
Okay.
So I recently rebooted our POCUS episode because Paul and I had attended two different conferences where we got to really get into this. And as a bedside teaching skill or just as a bedside tool, I feel like it's helping me connect with patients and learners. And just having a pocket ultrasound now, I'm not going to come out with the specific brand, but I will just say, if you do have a pocket ultrasound, or if you have access to a pocket ultrasound, or just ultrasound machines in your hospital, it is a lot of fun to be able to go to the bedside, look at people's heart, lungs, IVC, look at their, show people the insides of their bodies. They love it. And your kids will love it too. You can mess around at home if you want to. But I think that also the people that run these courses in the POCUS community are just amazing educators. They're so enthusiastic. They're so generous with their time and knowledge. I'm not being paid to say any of this, even though if it may seem that way, I'm just really excited about it. And I just want to mention it as much as possible on the show.
And how long were these conferences you went to?
So I went to the ACP course. That was a 2-day course. Unfortunately, I was sick for the second day, but Paul was at the second day. He tells me it was equally as good as the first day. And I went to the AIUM course, which was in Portland in July. I think they hold it in Portland every July. And also, again, amazing. Our chief of POCUS, Renee Diverstahl, is involved in both of those, and she puts on a great conference.
And how competent do you feel after doing those classes?
I think I need a lot more touches. That's where the pocket ultrasound comes in, but I can definitely identify structures. I can definitely start to say, is there a pericardial effusion? Is this EF depressed or not? Some like very binary type things. I feel like I'm like, are there curly B lines here? I think I'm getting there. And also the nice thing is, at least in my hospital at Cashlack, I can look at the formal echo, so I can compare my images to theirs, and I can get what was the read based on what I thought it was versus what the formal echo is. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to get immediate feedback on that. So I would recommend it.
Excellent. And my pick of the week is that I do not recommend a movie by the artist, the director formerly known as M. Night Shyamalan. I hear he's presently known as M. Night Shyamalan as well, but also formerly. A film called Glass. I watched it on the airplane flight here. It's pleasantly atrocious and whimsically boring. So
wait, so are you recommending this movie or
no,
not?
Not at all.
Okay.
Except for
the week is to avoid this like poison.
Yeah, well, there's
Should
only one
still
thing
link
that really
to it in the show
me.
Notes, or do you want us
yeah,
to
sure,
link
whatever,
to something else?
No, go ahead. So the only reason is because they have the same the same actor who played Bruce Willis's son in Unbreakable in 2000, who plays his son again in this film as well. So you kind of see him when he's 13, and now he's 31. I think it's hilarious because I don't know. He was 13. I was 30. I don't know. I found that hilarious.
So you're saying natural human aging you find hilarious?
No, because he was 13 and you flipped numbers. Now he's 30. Now, you know what?
Oh, I got you.
Yeah, it's just one of my autistic things, I think.
Okay, Hannah, maybe we should start out with the show at this point. Let's learn some actual things about hypernatremia.
You're never going to get those 10 minutes back.
Oh, man. But you'll be a better person for it.
Not this week.
All right. So just to start out, we wanted to ask you, I heard that there's a first lesson of hypernatremia. Can you tell us what it is?
Hypernatremia is the opposite of hyponatremia, right? That seems obvious, right? So it's a high sodium rather than a low sodium, but it's true in other ways. Like hyponatremia, that's hard. Hypernatremia, that's easy, right? And it's easy in a lot of different aspects. Like remember in hyponatremia, we had to worry about, oh, there's true hyponatremia, but don't get fooled by the false hyponatremia. There's no such thing as pseudo hypernatremia. If the sodium's high, the sodium is high, full stop. Okay. In hyponatremia, we had to meticulously watch the rate of correction. No need to worry about that in hypernatremia. We'll talk about some guidelines about what you want to hit. Those are just for style points. If you go too fast, you go too slow, no big deal. Okay. So hypernatremia, it's easy. It's just, we're going to get through it. We're going to go over it. And there's some frustrating aspects that people get wrong. But this is just, it's not the pressure cooker that hyponatremia is.
On that note, then, with that little reassurance, let's get to the case. So Miss Paula Urich is a 53-year-old female on whom you're being consulted for hypernatremia.
Does she like to go by Polly?
Well, that's her brother, but we'll get there later. You're going to hear from the Urich family tonight.
Her parents named their kids Paula and Polly. It's just cruel.
Paula and Polly.
Yeah. Occasionally he goes by Ollie. Anyway, she had been having some abdominal pain for a few weeks.
Her second cousin, Anne, who's on dialysis.
Oh, no. Oh, I'm so glad Paul's not here right now. All right. So Ms. Urich, she's been having abdominal pain for a few weeks, maybe weeks to months. Her primary care doctor sent her for a right upper quadrant ultrasound, and it showed gallstones. So she was scheduled for an outpatient cholecystectomy. On the morning of surgery, her pre-op lab showed a sodium of 155 from 143 in pre-op clinic 2 weeks prior. Her only other abnormal lab value was a calcium of 14.5. When you talk to her, you also find out that she's been drinking a lot more water than usual recently, and she's also been urinating a lot more. So the surgery is canceled, she's admitted, and they call us to find out what's going on.
Okay. So we have a patient with new onset hypernatremia, and we have hypercalcemia. So always the first and central question in hypernatremia is, why is the patient not drinking water, right? Even if you have a complete absence of ADH, which is one of the primary defenses against hypernatremia, if you have easy access to water, you'll be able to keep your sodium normal, okay? And so this patient, anytime you have someone who has a high sodium, you're like, well, why aren't you drinking water? Because that should defend against it. And this one's clear, right? Because the patient was made NPO after midnight, came in following those instructions, and so that's why she's not drinking water, is because her doctors told her not to. So this is iatrogenic hypernatremia. But we tell people to be NPO after midnight all the time, regularly, and they don't get hypernatremia. So there's actually, let me rewind a little bit. Let's talk about some of the other reasons people might not be able to drink water, right? So this one is because she was NPO after midnight. Some of the other possibilities are patients wandering in a desert. There's no water available. Obvious, they're not going to have water available. They're going to get hypernatremic. Patient is in a coma, right? Patient's in a coma, unable to drink water. They're going to get hypernatremic. Patients, babies. Babies can't ask for water. They depend on their parents to give them water. They're going to get hypernatremic, or we're going to be predisposed to that because they don't have that defense available to them. People in the ICU, even if they're not in a coma, tied to the bed, unable to secure water on their own, they're going to get hypernatremic, or are going to be predisposed to that. And then patients with altered mental status, would be another big class. And I think that's probably the most common ones that we see patients develop confusion for whatever, usually from bacteremia. And they don't ask for water. They don't get water on their own, come in with an elevated sodium. So that's your first step, is why aren't they drinking water? This is usually not much of a mystery, and that needs to be corrected.
What about the salt overdose type person?
Right. Right. So in that situation, right, even if they have an overdose of salt, if they're able to ask for water, they should be able to normalize their serum sodium. So the problem is, if it's severe enough, you know, the person who drinks a quart of soy sauce, they end up in a coma before they can drink enough water to neutralize that elevated sodium. Or you had mentioned earlier, salting the baby. Well, you know, there's a passage in Ezekiel in the Bible where they talk about rubbing salt on a newborn infant. And this is taken literally in some parts of the world. I think Turkey and Syria, I'm not absolutely certain of that. And they rub salt on the baby, and the skin is so thin, they'll absorb cutaneous sodium, and these children can have hypernatremia. And again, problem there is they can't ask for water. If they could, they would. Patients that have a cardiac arrest and are given a few rounds of sodium bicarbonate as part of the resuscitation, an amp of sodium bicarbonate has a sodium concentration of 1,000 millimoles per liter. And so you give a few of these rounds, you're going to develop hypernatremia. And those patients oftentimes are unable to stand up, walk over to the sink and get a glass of water following the resuscitation. I mean, maybe your resuscitations are more successful than mine, but usually they're just, that's not an option. So that even in cases of salt overdose, you still have to answer the question, why aren't they drinking water? The other key thing is that we mentioned that, patients that are kept MPO after midnight, like, they don't normally develop hypernatremia. Like, that's very unusual. There has to be something else going on. Yeah, we told her not to drink water, but there's something else going on. And the tell here is in her history, right? She reports multiple weeks of increased water intake, increased urination. And so this patient sounds like they have a lot of urine output. This is a typical,
Wouldn't you also have to think, like, is she just on a diuretic, or maybe she's surreptitiously, maybe she's taking a diuretic because she's like a bodybuilder or something, and she's trying to, you know, cut up for a show or something like that.
Right. And what I'd say in that situation, especially with loop diuretics, that's a cause of increased renal loss. So DI would be one example of that increased renal loss. Loop diuretic would be another one. Osmotic diuretic from uncontrolled diabetes would be another one. And it could be extra renal losses, diarrhea, insensible losses. Maybe she has burns over 80% of the body. I'm not sure if we mentioned that in her review of systems. Were there burns over 80% of her body, Hannah?
No, yeah. They didn't schedule her for an elective cholecystectomy with the burns. Yeah.
Yeah. So
she's good.
Yeah. So we can probably pair off. It's probably not insensible losses. And she did have the increased water intake and urination. So maybe that's diuretic induced. Maybe that's DI. Maybe that's an osmotic diuresis. Maybe she has uncontrolled diabetes. All those are possibilities.
Where she's and with loop diuretics, with the osmotic diuresis, with glucose, like you were talking about, you're losing much more water than you would be sodium. So that's why this is happening.
Yeah, right. Because when you have an osmotic diuresis, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system is intact. They're going to be able to reabsorb a lot of the sodium, preventing too much volume deficiency, but they will lose a lot of water. They're not going to be able to reabsorb all of the water. And so, exactly right, you're going to be losing relatively more water than sodium, predisposing you to the hypernatremia.
And I'm sure we're going to get into the thiazide diuretics at some point during this, because that's a bit different than the loops, right?
Completely different story.
Yeah,
that's right.
So we've got a couple reasons that she could potentially be hypernatremic. So if she's not able to drink like she is today, but then also something else going on, like a sodium overdose, loss of water, either renally or extrarenally, sort of diarrhea. But what do you think? She's got this calcium. What do you think is going on with her?
Yeah, I think the calcium is the obvious tell here, right? In the basic metabolic, there's also a calcium level. Calcium level is high, and that is one of two electrolyte abnormalities that causes a reversible nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, right? So hypercalcemia or hypokalemia can both cause nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, okay? And so just a quick reminder of what we're talking about with diabetes insipidus. So ADH normally is the hormone that causes you to retain water. It adds hydration to the body. And so its primary triggers is going to be an increase in osmolality. So you have an increase in osmolality and the body says, oh, we better dilute that with some water. So it prevents loss of water through the kidneys. And so you have this hormone that is made in the hypothalamus, vasopressin, stored in the posterior pituitary, and then released in response to increases in osmolality. That ADH then travels. There's two receptors. There's V1 receptors. It causes vasoconstriction. We're not concerned about that here. And there's V2 receptors that exist on the medullary collecting duct and a few other areas in the kidney, but the principal area we're talking about is the medullary collecting duct. So this is the very last structure in the nephron. Okay. And this is Matt's portion where you're going to fine tune the urine. Okay. And so, ADH binds or vasopressin binds the V2 receptor on the medullary collecting duct that causes pre-made aquaporin channels to get put into the epithelial membrane on the apical side. So it's going to be the water channel now in the urine channel where the tubular fluid can be reabsorbed. And the reason that it's reabsorbed is on the basolateral side of the medullary collecting duct is a very concentrated medullary interstitium. Right. This is the saltiest place in the body. Right. If you look at the entire body, the osmolality in the entire body is identical, 285, except for in the kidney. And then if you drill down to what portion of the kidney, the medullary collecting duct has this very, very intense salty brine with peak osmolality somewhere around 1200 millimoles per kilogram water. Super, super salty. It's kind of like the sauerkraut of the body.
Joel, you set that up for me, right? Like, because you're the loop, I'm the medullary collecting duct. If you're not doing if you're not doing your job, I can't, you know, the ADH response is going to be blunted, right, Joel?
Yeah. It's a Hannah and I worked for weeks on that, okay?
That is yeah, it's an alley loop, rather.
Hannah, I would like a graphic with me somehow as the medullary collecting duck and Joel as the loop, somehow alley-ooping. Yeah, anyway, I'll figure it out.
I really will. You guys can expect this on the show notes.
So the key part of this is that vasopressin opens the door, but you need to have that concentrated medullary interstitium to draw the water through, okay? And as Matt already alluded to, that concentrated medullary interstitium is generated by the loop of Henle, right? You've got the descending thin limb, the ascending thin limb, the thick ascending limb, and the countercurrent multiplier, and all that other stuff nobody really understands and just pretends to. All of that is driven by the thick ascending limb where you have the sodium-potassium 2-chloride channel, okay? And that's what's blocked by Lasix. But it's actually pretty interesting. So you have, think about it. You got a sodium, potassium, and 2-chloride. So that's 2 cations and 2 anions. And so it's a nice electroneutral transporter. Okay. However, we got plenty of chloride in the tubule and we got plenty of sodium in the tubule, but the potassium concentration is really low, right? If you think about chloride's about 100 and sodium's about 140 and potassium's 4. And so this molecule, this transporter would quickly extinguish, run out of potassium, and it would shut itself down. And so the body cleverly says, well, what we'll do is we'll reabsorb the potassium, and then we'll recycle it back out and be able to reabsorb it again. And so we just recycle the potassium, and it exits through a channel called ROM-K. Okay, so now you got 2-chloride going in, 1 sodium going in, and a potassium with no net movement because it comes in and then gets secreted back out. And so now you no longer have an electroneutral transporter. You actually are generating a negative charge on the inside of the cell, 2-chloride, 1 sodium, and a positive charge in the tubule fluid. And that positive charge is used to drive the reabsorption of calcium and magnesium. And they go through a paracellular pathway. So now what we have is we have a sodium potassium 2-chloride transporter, and we've been able to leverage that to also reabsorb not only sodium and potassium and chloride, but also calcium and magnesium. It's a really clever system. The calcium reabsorption is regulated. There's a calcium sensing receptor on the basolateral side, and every time the blood calcium concentration gets high, it shuts down ROM-K. That prevents potassium recycling. Potassium is quickly extinguished or runs out in the tubular fluid and essentially effectively shuts down the sodium-potassium 2-chloride transporter. So hypercalcemia actually exerts a Lasix-like effect at the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle.
I have never heard that before.
Yeah, I definitely did not understand that before this.
Yeah, but if you think about patients that have hypercalcemia, well, what are one of the symptoms? Well, they are all volume depleted. That sounds like Lasix. They all complain of polyuria and polydipsia. Oh, that sounds like Lasix too. And they all have this, usually have a pre-renal azotemia. Oh, well, that sounds like Lasix too, right? Like it, when you start to think about it, it fits the picture pretty well. And so if you have prolonged hypercalcemia, just like being on prolonged Lasix, you're going to be predisposed to hypernatremia because you're going to wash out that medial interstitium because you can't, if your thick ascending limb is no longer working, you're not going to be able to generate or maintain that concentrated medial interstitium so that even in the presence of ADH, even if you open up that door, you're not going to have that concentrated medial interstitium pulling the water from the tubular fluid. And so what we're talking about is even in the presence of ADH, you don't get a lot of water reabsorption. That's the definition of nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. Mm. And so that's what's happening. There's also probably a mechanism where calcium blocks vasopressin activity at the cortical, at the medullary collecting duct. But this calcium sensing receptor blocking the ROMK is way cooler.
So for this patient, all we've got to do is figure out why she's hypercalcemic and treat her.
There you go. That was when I got this consult. When they pulled in the chief of Cashlac, I was like, I got this. I was like, what? Watch me strut my stuff. All right. So, you know, when you're working up the hypercalcemia, you know, first thing you want to do is you want to say, is it the most common outpatient cause of hypercalcemia is a primary hyperparathyroidism? And so we're like, okay, let's take a look at the PTH, and the PTH is suppressed. So we can rule out primary hyperpara. PTH is responding normally. Then we are looking at causes of PTH independent hypercalcemia. So you're going to have hypercalcemia of malignancy, which can be in the form of skeletal invasion. So you could get a skeletal survey. We didn't do that here, but it would have been negative because that's not the diagnosis. You can get a PTHRP, which we didn't do because we already had the diagnosis. You can check. You can have a elevated 125 vitamin D. You can have immobilization. Have we hit all of them? And milk alkali syndrome. And so patient wasn't taking Tums, no milk alkali, no calcium carbonate in her history. She denies taking vitamin D, so no vitamin D intoxication is not likely. But additionally, we checked a 25 OHD, and that was low. And that's the nutritional form of vitamin D. But then we checked a 125, the active form of vitamin D, and that was 113, which is pretty high. And that was driving her hypercalcemia. Okay, now she's not getting this nutritionally. This is not too much, you know, not a exogenous source. She's just converting her endogenous 25-OH vitamin D to the active form in an unregulated fashion. And there's just a couple of diseases that cause that. Lymphoma can cause that. Any of the granulomatous diseases can cause that. And sure enough, on review of systems, she had a cough. And we checked an abnormal chest x-ray, one mediastinum, and she had sarcoidosis as the etiology.
Very cool case.
Yeah, so slam dunk. You started Miss Urich on prednisone, and a week later, her sodium is 142, her calcium is 10. She's still having a little bit of polyuria, polydipsia, but they send her home, they reschedule her for surgery 2 weeks after the original admission.
Yeah, so...
And what do you know?
Oh. Well, I just want to add that the forms of hypercalcemia that are due to 125 vitamin D are exquisitely sensitive to steroids. You know, that steroids is oftentimes listed as a treatment for hypercalcemia. This is the time it really works the best. And she had a beautiful response here. Okay. So we were in the morning of surgery. Yeah, we fixed her. We sent her home. And she was still complaining of that polyuria and polydipsia. But our reasoning was it takes a little while for her to reconstitute her medullary interstitium. And we just said, hey, give it a few days and this polyuria and polydipsia is going to get better and you're going to do fine as long as that calcium remains well controlled.
So in other words, the loop would start working again. She would regenerate that gradient so that when ADH is there, it can bring the water gets drawn out of the distal tubule into the interstitium.
Those are perfect words, yes.
So the morning of surgery, she comes in and her sodium is 158. So now what do we do?
Yeah. Okay. So, and on that basic metabolic, what was her calcium?
Normal. I don't think we...
10. It's 10 it was now. 10. Yeah, it's 10.
It was still 10. 10. Yeah. It was still 10. Yeah. So this is kind of a rinse, wash, repeat type of situation, right? Surgery thinks we're nuts. They brought her back 2 weeks later. She has the exact same problem. It's not the exact same problem, right? Because the obvious cause of nephrogenic DI is no longer there. And she doesn't have the hypercalcemia. And so this time, we're going to have to dig a little deeper. Like the first time when we saw her, like the diagnosis just slapped us in our face and we didn't dig deep. We're like, oh, it's the hypercalcemia, obviously. This time we had to work up the cause. Now, again, she still has the complaint of polyuria and polydipsy. We still think she has diabetes insipidus, but there's not an obvious cause of nephrogenic diabetes insipidus here. So the first step here is you want to evaluate whether it's nephrogenic or central. Right, and I guess you'd want to rule out an osmotic diuresis, check a blood sugar, make sure she doesn't have a glucose of 500 that could be contributing to this. And she doesn't. And when you want to differentiate central diabetes insipidus, which is the inability to produce ADH, from nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, which is the inability to respond to ADH, all you do is you give them pharmacologic ADH and you see if they respond. Right, so you give them a dose of DDAVP, which is a semi-synthetic form of vasopressin. It does not bind the V1 receptors, which is great, so you don't get this hypertensive response, this vasospastic response, which you don't want. But you do get a nice brisk response to the V2 receptors. And if they have an intact medullary interstitium and they have a kidney that responds to the ADH, you're going to get an immediate drop in urine output. You get an immediate increase in urinary concentration. And this is exactly what happened. We gave her a dose of IV DDAVP. Urine output immediately fell. She'd been making 8-10 liters of urine before, dropped down immediately to a normal level or near normal level. We then proceeded to, we need to figure out what's going on in her brain. And so I remember going in the next morning. We'd scheduled her for an MRI and went in to see her in the morning. And she was so grateful. She's like, Dr. Toff, chief of nephrology at Cash Lab. That was the first night I've been able to sleep through the night in weeks. I got the best night of sleep I'd ever had. And she had been waking up every 2 or 3 hours, not to go to the bathroom. She'd been waking up because she had such intense thirst. Her thirst was waking up, and then she would be in the bathroom drinking water. I might as well go to the bathroom now. But she was very specific. It was a thirst that woke her up. That was so dramatic to me. And she was immensely grateful. And we got the MRI, and turned out she had neurosarcoidosis, and she had a Goomba right on her pituitary that was causing the central diabetes insipidus.
Such a good case.
Yeah, so she had both peripheral diabetes insipidus from the hypercalcemia that kind of partially resolved, and then she also had central diabetes insipidus from the neurosarcoidosis. And both were only really revealed when she was NPO for surgery.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things that she had the classic complaints of diabetes insipidus, that she was drinking water all the time, she was peeing all the time, but she was able to maintain a normal serum sodium, which is usually what they do, at the expense of like being able to live their lives because their full-time job is now drinking water.
I wonder how often this is missed, because we always think, is it diabetes? Are they on diuretics? And, maybe they're just drinking a lot of soda or coffee or something. And I just wonder how often it's missed. I guess it would persist and eventually you'd probably figure it out, but...
Yeah, these are not common diseases.
Yeah,
this is. I don't think we have a silent epidemic of DI underneath the surface. I think we're truly talking about a rare disease.
The other thing I was going to ask you, we talked about a little bit in pre-recording. This so DDAVP is that also same as desmopressin, right? It's the same.
Yeah.
Same.
Yeah.
And when we did our show on BPH, the urologist we were talking to, he mentioned that. Desmopressin is a drug that some people are now using for nocturia to kind of help people sleep through the night. It made me think of that when you were talking about this woman. So I have not had the occasion to use this yet. I'm not sure if Stuart has started to use it since that time, or if Paul was here, we could ask him. But what do you recommend this, Joel? Does it seem a safe enough practice?
I've tried it a couple times, and I have not yet found a patient who had a good response to it. Mm-hmm. That patients usually had their polyuria or their nocturia didn't change. That was my experience, and maybe I'm doing a poor job at patient selection.
I wonder if it's because it's more of like an irritative symptom. Like urgency is more of an irritative symptom. It's not like they're making tons and tons of urine. So
you're saying they need to drink more water?
I just think that they need...
How confusing can we
They
be?
Need something different. I just think that... I derailed us. Let's get back. Hannah, let's get back to the case.
You derailed us. Anyway, all right. Sorry, guys. All right. So kind of talking a little bit about DDAVP, do you have any tips in terms of advising people sort of what they can expect on the drug? What is it like in terms of financial toxicity? Is this sort of an insulin or is this a warfarin in terms of how much it's going to cost people?
So I looked it up on a good RX and it was about $1 a day for the drug. So not too bad. I mean, it's not warfarin, but it's certainly not insulin either. So not too expensive. And you know, one of the things about this drug, it's kind of a lifestyle drug, right? You take the medication to lower the urine output. They're able to maintain their sodium without it, right? As she showed, but this will just allow her to have the freedom to not be attached to a water bottle all the time.
All right. So I think we can move on to our next case. Our next case is Paula's father, Mr. Manny Urich, who is a 78-year-old man who was hospitalized this morning for treatment of increased urine output and altered mental status. So he comes in and his sodium is 162. What kind of factors could be predisposing Mr. Urich to hypernatremia?
Right. So again, just like, the first question always in hypernatremia is why is this patient not drinking? And in all the cases, again, it's usually pretty obvious. In this one, we have the altered mental status to blame. And the important thing is if you're saying the altered mental status is due to the hypernatremia, then you can't say that the hypernatremia is the lack of water is due to the altered mental status. Like the altered mental status has to come first. Then they stop drinking and then they develop the hypernatremia. So he has something causing the hypernatremia. I don't know if he's got sepsis, which is not an uncommon cause of that in the elderly, but something that would need to be investigated. But the altered mental status is generating causing the patient to fail to drink water. And it's unclear from the stem, at least that I can see why he might have, I guess he has the increased urine output as the cause of the what's predisposing him to lack of water plus the increased urine output leading to hypernatremia.
And in general, kind of why do patients get hypernatremic in the ICU? What is this ICU hypernatremia phenomenon?
Yeah, so, hypernatremia is unfortunately too common in the ICU, right? Once patients are in the ICU, they're really dependent on the intensive care team to play hypothalamus and kind of regulate their sodium for them, right? Patients aren't going to be able to self-regulate by asking for water and drinking water because they're in a coma or they're sedated or they're tied to a bed or what have you. And this is something, and then if you correlate changes in elevations in sodium to ICU mortality, I mean, they run together pretty tightly. I don't think many people believe that the mortality is due to the hypernatremia. They kind of feel like this is a marker for how attentive their ICU care is. And that the fact that as their sodium rises, their hospital mortality also rises, indication that they're probably not getting the best medical care. And some groups are using sodium hypernatremia as a marker of quality in ICUs. So if you want to be working in a good ICU, you know, pay attention to their sodium every morning to make sure you correct it.
All right. So we're going to do that. The ICU team will. So his body weight is 60 kilograms. His urine output, we estimate it's around 6 liters a day. His urine sodium is 30. Urine potassium is 15. He's not drinking any water, but he is getting antibiotics in a liter of normal saline a day and 125 milliliters an hour of maintenance LR. So they red salted. So kind of to start out with, that was a whole lot of numbers. How do we treat hypernatremia? in this kind of setting.
And Joel, I wanted to just bring up before, because the labs here, should people be sending plasma and urine osms as well when they're working up hypernatremia? Is that necessary? Was there any other tests you would have sent along with this?
Good question.
Yeah.
If you're looking for a diagnosis of diabetes insipidus, which this guy may have, you'll need the urine osmolality. And so what you're expecting in somebody who's got hypernatremia is for them to turn their urine osmolality up as high as possible, right? And so for patients with intact kidney function, no chronic kidney disease, they should be able to crank that up to 1,200, okay? Young, healthy people, intact kidneys up to 1,200. Oftentimes, we'll see patients that are on chronic diuretics, have chronic kidney disease, and they may only be able to get their urine osmolality up to 800 or so. But urine osmolality will give you a sense. And so if you have an inappropriately dilute urine in the presence of hypernatremia, there's going to be your diagnosis of diabetes insipidus. Okay. So urine osmolality is helpful. A serum osmolality, again, we mentioned at the very top of the podcast that we don't have a situation here like with sodium where you have to make sure that the osmolality is decreased when the sodium is decreased, so you get a true hyponatremia. No, you don't have to worry about that here, right? If the sodium is elevated, they've got hypernatremia. There's no exceptions. There's no trick questions here. So I'm not sure what value you get from the serum osmolality in this situation. There are two calculations that you need to do in treating hypernatremia. So the first one is you need to figure out what their fluid deficit is. So the fluid deficit says, okay, I've got a sodium here. It's 162. How much water do I need to add to this patient to get their sodium down to a target level? My target level is going to be a serum sodium 12 below where we are right now, or a sodium of 144, whichever one is a smaller difference. So from 162 minus 12 gets us to 150. So my target here is 150. And to get the fluid deficit, all I do is I take current sodium, 162, minus target sodium, 150, that's 12. Divide that by our target sodium, which is 150, and that's going to be your percent that the sodium is elevated. I think that was 8% in this case. Mm-hmm. And then you multiply that by their total body water. And the conventional equation for total body water is 60% of body weight. But you need to make some adjustments there. So it's 60% of total body weight for a young, lean male. And as you get older and fatter, that number gets lower, right? So, and as you get more female. So generally, women, you'll knock that down by 10%. So 50% of body weight for women. If you're an elderly man, it'll also be 50% of body weight. So elderly women, about 45%. But if you get somebody who's very obese, right? Because the thing to remember is that muscle is 75% water and fat is only 10% water. So as a higher proportion of your weight is generated by adipose tissue, your percent body water for your total body is going to go down. And I wish I could tell you that there was a good equation to do this, to figure out what that percent body water is, but I really just kind of go in and get a look at the patient and get a feel for it and take a guess.
There's got to be a calculator you can use to just that plugs in some of the numbers for you.
Well, so if you take a look at most of the calculators, they'll ask the age and gender. And from there, they try to figure out the adiposity. And I was like, that's absurd, right? Like, but that's what the calculators have right now. If you take a look at MedCalc they're not good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. MedCalc has like, are they a child, adult, or elderly? Is the sex male or female? And then their weight, their sodium, and the desired sodium.
Right. You would think that BMI would be important. Right. You would think that some kind of measure, you know, give me some skinfold thickness. That's what I need.
Right.
Sounds like a chance to have your name on a formula.
Oh my gosh. That would be, if I could get my name on a formula, complete.
Is that making it in the nephrology world? Is that?
Oh, yes.
All right. But right now we've kind of got what we've got. And can you kind of walk us through the math for this patient?
Right. So we got 8% and we said he was 60 kilograms and what we said, 50% water is what we went with.
Yes. Yeah.
And so that came out to 2.4 liters of fluid deficit. And so this is the water deficit. And I see time and time again, people stop here. And I think this is what happens with this team right here.
Yeah. So the team says, great. Did all this math. It turned out to be 2.4 liters in 24 hours. So in order to replace that, we're just going to give 100 milliliters an hour for 24 hours.
Of
so they
fluid?
Do that.
What fluid did they give?
Of D5W. Yeah.
That's right. And so the ideal fluid, you're trying to give water, right? So D5W is a good approximation of water. But if the patient's bowels working, and this patient doesn't seem to have any reason that their bowels are not working, like, you know, if you have a NG or OG or a PEG that you can give water in, that's the ideal fluid, and you're going to be doing better with that. Sometimes these calculations, especially for bigger people and higher degrees of hypernatremia, are huge volumes. And as you give more and more D5W, you run the risk of developing hyperglycemia. And the hyperglycemia generates osmotic diuresis, and osmotic diuresis develops more hypernatremia. And so you can start to be chasing your tail as you start to titrate up the D5W higher and higher. So if you can avoid D5W in any way, you should.
You mean like with a quarter normal saline with no, you know, no extra, like if you were going to have to give it IV?
No, that's the problem. Once you have to give it IV, you're kind of trapped, and the D5 is going to be the fluid that you give most often. Why don't we give sterile water in an IV, right? Because it's low osmolality and it'll cause hemolysis. You can't give sterile water into the blood vessels.
Ah, that's right.
So ideally, you want to use the GI tract.
So this patient doesn't currently have an NG. We don't know how long this is going to last, and he's not really drinking water because of his mentation. So they go with 100 milliliters an hour for the next day, and they recheck his sodium 24 hours later, and it's 168. So they call in the salt whisperer. So what's going on?
Yeah. So what they did is they only did half the calculation. They looked at the water deficit, but they didn't look at the ongoing losses, right? This patient's making 6 liters of urine a day, and they just ignored that and assumed that the patient was losing, you know, I guess isotonic fluid in that. And that's not the case, right? So we can do that. Now we have to rerun the calculation. Sodium is now 168. Correction of 12 brings you down to 156. Now the calculations comes out to 2.3 liters for that, because it's only about a 7.7% reduction rather than 8%. Excuse me, a 7.7% increase in sodium rather than the 8%. Okay, so we're going to do 2.3 liters to get the fluid deficit. That's to bring it down to 156. But then we need to account for the ongoing losses. And so patient's making 6 liters of urine. And what I generally say is that the formal calculation is called an electrolyte free water clearance. And what you're going to do is you're going to say, what proportion of that 6 liters of urine is just pure water, with the balance of it being all of the cations at the same concentration in plasma? I'm not sure I want to go too deep into this, but the calculation is you take the urine sodium plus urine potassium, and you divide that by the serum sodium, and that's going to give you your kind of electrolyte content. Take 1 minus that, that's going to be your water content, and you multiply that by the urine volume. But what I would advise is kind of a quick and dirty thing, that if the patient's making a liter or less of urine, you can just ignore it. It's not important. That's not going to be contributing a lot to the disease. As their urine output gets over a liter, up to about 3 liters, you need to start accounting for that urine, and you can just use half the urine volume at that low volume. Once you're going beyond 3 liters, I would just take all of that urine volume. So for this case, making 6 liters. So for the first liter, we're going to ignore it. For the next 2 liters, we'll take half, so that's 1 liter. And for the 3 liters through 6 liters is 3, so that's going to be 4 liters of water that you need to account for. Does that equation make sense, what I just laid out?
Yeah. So this is in addition to what we calculated as the free water deficit.
There's the free water deficit is what I call yesterday. That's what happened up to now, and that's how far we are behind.
Right.
Then we got to account for how much water they're going to lose today,
mm-hmm.
and that we're just going to be looking at their urine output. And you can go through the calculation, or you can just say, "Hey, I'm going to ignore the first liter. For the second and third liter, I'm going to take half of that volume. And if they only have 3 liters, that's 1 liter there and you're done. Mm-hmm. For any liter above 3, I'm going to take all of it.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so in this case, we get 1 liter for the first 3 liters. Mm-hmm. And we get 3 liters for the next 3 liters. You add them together, you get 4 liters. Hannah gave us a urine sodium of 32 and a urine potassium of 15. Add that together, we get 47. Divide that by 168. Take 1 minus that. Multiply that by 6 and you get 4.3. So
you were very close with the, yeah.
So the rough calculation is pretty good. And the, but if you want to do the precise calculation, if you have the numbers available, you can do the precise calculation.
I do not want to do that. I love the other method that you described. So basically you're going to take the 2.3 liter deficit and then about this other 4 liters we expect.
Add that on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and now you can see how different it is. The calculations only comes out to 2.3 liters if you don't include urine losses. If you include the urine losses, it's now 6.7 by the full calculation and 6.3 with the partial calculation. It's a hugely different number.
And this is serious enough that you would have a Foley in this patient? Like someone with the sodium in the high 150s or 160s, would you have a Foley in them so you get really accurate urine so that you can do this calculation?
Here's what I'd say. I'd say if patients in the ICU with altered mental status and they're making 6 liters of urine a day, your nurses are really going to appreciate you having a Foley in the patient. Right? You're cleaning that bed up all the time otherwise.
Right. Okay.
Right? I mean, this patient's going to be sitting in urine. Like you need this for hygiene aspect. And I don't care if it's a condom catheter. You're going to need something.
It's either that or you like pages.
So I wanted to ask about this because this comes up. I mean, what if you thought this patient was hypovolemic as well? Are you running a separate IV with saline to beef up their volume as well?
Yeah, and I think that's the right way to solve this problem is that you're going to run one IV to correct the osmolality and you're going to run one IV to correct the volume deficit. And in fact, in this case, Hannah mentioned this patient's on LR, I think at 125 an hour. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. And the antibiotics.
And they're getting a liter of antibiotics. I don't know what antibiotic we're giving. I think we're maybe treating them for syphilis or something.
I think for asymptomatic bacteria, we don't really know.
Oh, dear, we are not giving IV antibiotics for asymptomatic bacteria. I know who listens to this podcast. That's not happening here. One of the issues that always comes up is we do this calculation. It's 6.7 liters or 280 ml per hour. Of free water. And so, first of all, if you write 280 ml per hour of D5W, you're going to get into trouble with just the patient, right? They're also getting 125 cc's an hour of LR. Like, this is just a ton of volume. So this is why we like using the GI tract if possible. This is a real compelling reason that let's get an NG tube down, right? You know, and let's give at least half of this or maybe 2/3 of this volume enterally. Right. 200 cc's an hour is, that's 6 ounces. We're not talking about a massive amount of fluid when you're thinking about the enteral tract, but through an IV, it ends up being that's a notable amount. All right. And then oftentimes these patients are intubated or they have a history of heart failure. Maybe the reason that you have hypernatremia is you've been pushing the loop diuretics because they have heart failure. And now you come in and you say, well, I need to give a 200 an hour of D5W. And cardiology is like, no, you're not. You know, one of the things to remember is that only 10% of this volume is going to remain in the plasma. 90% of this is going to be going to the interstitium and two-thirds of it actually goes into the intracellular compartment, completely disappears. And so it's important to remind cardiology that, yeah, this is volume and it's going to be counted on the eyes and nose, but it's not saline. We're not giving this something that's going to really expand the extracellular compartment. Very modest event, modest increase to the extracellular compartment. Sometimes you can convince cardiology. sometimes you can't.
I think this is also why there's been a couple studies. Tony Brew had sent these out on Twitter probably a year or so ago now, where the fluid restricting patients with heart failure exacerbation, like, you know, people have these signs, fluid restrict 1 liter of free water. Mm. I think it doesn't make sense, and it doesn't pan out when you study it. I don't know what you think there, Joel, but.
Well, I think it's important to, what are you trying to do with that fluid restriction?
Make yourself feel better.
But it's not the volume, right? That's, you know, it's not trying to match up the eyes and nose. You're trying to prevent hyponatremia, which these heart failure patients are susceptible to. And right. I think that's a laudable goal.
Okay.
But
so, right.
But remember, that's what you're trying to treat, is the hyponatremia.
But most of them, like, don't most of the, that. that's not what it's being used for. I agree. Like, if the sodium's sub 130 and, you know, you don't have another reason for it.
Yeah. No, agree. I want to follow up and see that Tony Brew tutorial. It's excellent work. It's right up my alley.
Well, speaking of tutorials, so let's say, okay, the sodium, you know, we called in the salt whisper. You kind of helped us see that we needed to account for the urine losses. So now the patient's sodium goes from 168 to 150 in a day. Should we panic and start, you know, administering hypertonic saline to get us back to this 12 millimoles per day? Or what do we do?
Right. So, okay. So this is the freak out here is that we have a target of 112, or it can be a change of 12 in 24 hours, and we ended up going 18 in 24 hours. And if we were raising the sodium in a patient with chronic hyponatremia, we would immediately say, hey, we need to re-lower because we went too fast and we're at risk of central pontymyelinolysis. So the question is, do you have a symmetric risk from rapid correction of hypernatremia, right? And if you think about developing acute hyponatremia where you get a sudden drop in sodium from drinking too much water, those patients can get cerebral edema, right? And we have patients that run marathons and get water intoxication and they have a seizure and they die. Like, it is not a minor consideration. So the question is, well, if you know, if we know going from 140 to 120 acutely can cause a seizure and patients can die, what about going from 170 to 150? Do they have the same risk? And the answer is no, they don't have the same risk. Now, it's a logical consideration. And in fact, if you're an infant, there is data that rapid correction of sodium in infants does predispose to seizures. Okay, that's an important thing. But in adults, there is not a single credible case report ever of an adult developing cerebral edema from rapid correction of hypernatremia. Not one case report. Yeah. And there's been a couple of retrospective reviews where they have looked at correction of hypernatremia, you know, 1,000 patients that have had correction of hypernatremia. What are the neurologic outcomes of people that get slow correction versus patients that get rapid correction? Correction that is faster than recommended guidelines. And the neurologic outcomes are the same. And even in those comprehensive reviews, not a single case of cerebral edema. And so my sense is, hey, we want to be cautious. Let's target 12 because there's a mechanistic reason why that going faster may be problematic. But in no way do I want to start re-raising the sodium with hypertonic saline if we go too fast. I just don't care that much. Okay. And usually the problem is you go too slow, that you try to correct it and it doesn't get any better. There's a C. Jason article that came out this past spring.
Yep. May 2019 looks at critically ill patients and rapid correction of hypernatremia, no increased risk of mortality, neurological outcomes. Realistically, I can't find a lot of art. I mean, I looked on PubMed just thinking maybe I could find something. There's nothing. You're
yeah.
right.
Yeah. So that's actually a great article. We covered it in FJC. We discussed it in Freely Filtered. I'm not sure if you heard that I have a podcast.
I heard that episode. That was part of my prep for this, Joel.
Excellent. So there's an editorial that was published with that, written by Richard Stearns, who he's one of the editors of Up to Date on the electrolyte section, a author of the hyponatremia guidelines, the U.S. guidelines on hyponatremia. I mean, he really is a legend when it comes to sodium. And He specifically states there has never been a case, a convincing case. His words were a convincing case report of cerebral edema from rapid correction of hypernatremia. And I just absolutely believe him. And he really points out that the idea that we want this kind of symmetric risk, we want hypernatremia to be like hyponatremia. And he's like, yeah, it's just not. Sorry.
It's the opposite, I heard. Yeah.
It's the opposite. That's right.
With that in mind, is it, do you check once a day? Do you check Q12? I mean, rather than Q4, you know?
I think that's exactly where you should go. Like, we need to recognize that we're not dealing with a critical illness like we worried about with hyponatremia. We're not going to be adjusting these things hour by hour. So let's give the nurses a break. Let's give the patient a break. And let's just check this Q12 or Q24, I think is totally appropriate.
Yeah. I think the textbooks are still behind in this for sure. Like,
yeah, they are. Definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, that's shocking.
But luckily, there's a tutorial that we'll link to in the show notes that actually walks through all of it, and it even has a GIF. So we'll go ahead and link to that in the show notes, yeah.
I think we should start to wrap up here. Hannah, take us home.
All right. We just had a couple kind of fast facts questions that we wanted to ask you about, sort of some special scenarios in hypernatremia. So the first one was this whole question of thiazides versus acetazolamide for nephrogenic DI. What's kind of the latest on that?
Okay. So if nephrogenic DI is not due to these electrolyte abnormalities, so we talked about hypokalemia and hypercalcemia as causing a reversible nephrogenic DI, throw an osmotic diuresis and loop diuretics on there. Those are easy to correct, right? If the loop diuretic is the problem, stop the loop diuretic, fix the calcium. But there are patients with congenital nephrogenic DI, and there's patients with long-term exposure to lithium developing nephrogenic diabetes insipidus as a consequence of this. These are really difficult cases to manage. And one of the conventional therapies has been giving patients a thiazide type diuretic. And the idea there is you induce a bit of volume depletion and they get increased fluid reabsorption in other aspects of the ADH independent aspects of the nephron. So they'll get a decrease in GFR. They'll get increased reabsorption in the proximal tubule. And so you can minimize their urine output distally. And that's been the kind of the dogma. And then there was some animal studies where they induced lithium-induced nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, and they had a knockout mouse that was missing the sodium chloride co-transporter. So they were congenitally unable to respond to thiazide diuretics, and the thiazide still worked, and it caused a lot of head scratching. And then they tried acetazolamide on those, and the rats had a dramatic reduction in urine output. And one of the things about thiazides is they do have a bit of a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor activity. And the thought is that focusing on the proximal tubule, where acetazolamide is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, works in the proximal tubule, ends up being a relatively weak diuretic. It actually is very potent at reducing this lithium-induced increased urine output, this DI. And after this animal studies, there was a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine where they demonstrated it in a patient, and it was a dramatic, it was like a light switch, how fast and how responsive their urine output was to the acetazolamide. You know, 8-12 liters, start the acetazolamide, goes down to like 2 or 3 liters, stop the acetazolamide, goes right back up to 8 to 12 liters. You know, they could turn it on and turn it off. And I've tried it in a few patients, and I've been really impressed with how effective it is. I think this is a much better therapy than the thiazides are.
There was a patient kicking around Cashlack in the past year or two, and she had schizoaffective disorder. Lithium had caused nephrogenic DI, and it was very hard to get her to drink because, you know, she was basically living in an inpatient psych, and they would consult us as medicine and be like, help us out. She's not drinking. So she'd eventually get readmitted, then they're tying her to the bed, which doesn't make sense because, you know, she won't drink water. So then they're giving her water, and she's on thiazide diuretics and they're trying to mess around with the Millerite. I wonder if this would be something that would have worked for her, this acetazolamide. It wasn't brought up. It wasn't something that, I don't think it's like widespread knowledge, but it was like a really difficult case. Like you felt, even on the thiazide diuretic twice a day and given the IV fluids and stuff, like you couldn't keep someone on IV fluids for the rest of their life. So it was a big problem.
Yeah, the thing to remember with the thiazides is you want to induce volume deficiency. So part of the game is you need to also have them a little sodium restricted. You can't give them free access to salty foods that'll restore their volume, right? You're trying to induce a little bit of pre-renal azotemia, if you will. But the acetazolamide, like I said, I would absolutely, if I encounter that patient again, I'd give them a shot of acetazolamide and see how well it worked.
And that's the mechanism there. Is it well understood? Is it worth getting into, or is it a little bit too high level for our purposes?
So you know, anytime you read in a textbook, the explanation for this is beyond the scope of this text. That's you know, that's just code for the author going, I have no idea what's going on here. And so we're just going to go with, yeah, you know, that's just a beyond the scope of this podcast.
Okay. Hannah, anything else before we get take-home points, or do you want to jump to take-home points?
Let's do some take-home points.
Okay. Take-home point for number one for hypernatremia, when you see the patient, figure out why they're not drinking water and correct that. Okay. Second one, look for things that are going to predispose that. What kind of loss of water do they have from the body? Is it renal, like DI or diuretics? Or is it extrarenal, diarrhea, insensible losses through the skin, high fevers, all those can predispose. Don't forget the possibility of salt intoxication, soy sauce ingestion, sodium bicarbonate use in a code situation, hypertonic saline for whatever, what have you. When it comes to therapy for hypernatremia, calculate the fluid deficit. The calculators are freely available, but don't forget the ongoing losses. So the ongoing losses, take a look at it. If their patient is oliguric, you don't need to worry about it. But the more urine they make, the more important it is to watch it.
All right. And did you have anything that you wanted to plug?
No, I think just the freely filtered podcast. If you're interested in this type of stuff and you kind of like the stuff that we do at the Twitter Journal Club and FJC, this is kind of a director's cut of NEFJC, where you get we've got a really good crew of five people. We have Jenny Lin, who's a basic scientist at Northwestern University. We have Samira Farouk, who's a transplant nephrologist at Sinai in New York City. We have Swapnil Hiremath, who's a epidemiologist in Ottawa. We have Matt Sparks, who's a basic scientist, a vascular blood pressure researcher, vascular researcher at Duke, and myself, and we kind of hash through these studies and bring up interesting aspects, including a deep dive in the nature of all the placebos and all the placebo controlled trials. We go deep into the minutiae. We really, it's a long tail podcast, as we like to say.
So Joel, I can't thank you enough, as always. This was this one. I did, you know, I thought this was a fairly, I mean, you said it's simple, but it is still, you know, it's not that easy, maybe for nephrologists, but I do like the fact that you don't have to worry about pseudo. Yeah, there's a lot of math, but you simplified it. I mean, like and there's a calculator for the free water deficit, and then you simplified the electrolyte free water clearance.
And there are calculators for the free water clearance. You'll find them also, and that's what they're called. It's electrolyte. Yeah. It's called electrolyte free water clearance, and it'll guide you through everything you got to plug in there. It's not that difficult.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Insert yummy here.
Get show notes at thecurbsiders.com/podcast and sign up for our mailing list at thecurbsiders.com/knowledgefood to get our delicious weekly show notes in your inbox.
That's right, not Paul, because we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or contact us at thecurbsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producer for this episode, Hannah R. Abrams. And hello. To our social media team, again, Hannah R. Abrams on Twitter, Beth Garbs Garbatelli on Instagram, and Chris, the Chewy Manju, on Facebook. Until next time, I've been Dr. Stuart Kent Brigham.
Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
I've been Hannah Rebecca Abrams.
And there's no Paul Williams, so...
Oh, no. Thank you and good night.
Good night.